From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Just hours ago in London, the British Parliament defeated a motion opposing war with Iraq. The vote was 396 to 217. A second vote approved the government's resolution supporting the use of all means necessary to ensure Iraq's disarmament. It passed 412 to 149. Tonight on Point, Tony Blair's last stand for war and what Great Britain wins and loses in the battle. We begin with a first-hand report from near the Iraqi border, where today U.S. soldiers stationed in the Kuwaiti desert got the order to break camp and be ready to move. Jim Dwyer is a correspondent with the New York Times, embedded with the U.S. Army's 101st Airborne Division. I asked Jim where he is today and what he's been seeing.
I'm in the desert north of Kuwait City, not too far from the Iraqi border. I'm in a camp called Camp New Jersey that is occupied primarily by United States Army and the 101st Airborne Division. They were practicing today with live fire ammunition, which is something that is done to calibrate the velocity of their weapons and their howitzers. The muzzle velocity have to be adjusted to the precise rounds, the kind of rounds that they're going to be using when they actually go into combat. They're practicing helicopter landings in the sand. Those are very tricky because the sand rises up as the helicopters descend and reduces visibility to very low levels, and pilots almost landing blind for the last 25 feet or so because of the clouds of sand that rise up from the desert. We're also experiencing very high winds. They're apparently building up to quite a good sandstorm over the next 24 hours. So all in all, plan your vacation elsewhere is my advice.
Jim Dwyer, could you feel the chemistry change there today as word of the president's ultimatum no doubt spread through the camp?
Yes. I mean, people have known even prior to the president's speech, it was clear over the weekend that the plans and the practice and the rehearsals had moved into a different phase even before the president made his speech on Monday night. Units were told to pack their war bags, that is their personal garments and what they're going to carry with them as they go north and go across the border. So the chemistry has been changing, I would say, for the last 3 or 4 days once it became clear that the diplomatic process was not going to avert this war. It's also clear that people were very interested in hearing what the president had to say. In fact, some of the soldiers got up at 4 o'clock in the morning, Kuwait time, to hear what he had to say in his speech, although I did hear that they couldn't find a TV, unfortunately, to hear it, but they later picked it up on the, some of them have satellite TVs, and they were able to get it during the day.
Jim Dwyer, you're with the 101st Airborne Division. When the attack comes, is it known to all what these troops will be doing? Is it a secret? Can we talk about it?
Yeah, well, I think we can talk about it because, I mean, they are a specific purpose battle division, and their purpose is to fly helicopter gunships long distances and to attack armored regiments on the ground. So we are in Kuwait, which is about 400 miles from the border up to Baghdad. And as I understand it, there are members of the Iraqi Republican Guard ringed around Baghdad. And these helicopters will be used to go down and kill those regiments, to destroy them or to neutralize them. And the way they hunt them is they have two kinds of helicopters that do it. One is called a Kiowa, which is a very small helicopter that has a lot of radar and surveillance equipment on it, and it shares this over some kind of network with the rest of the battleship helicopters. The Kiowa is not a battleship helicopter, it's just a surveillance one. And then the Apaches are the real killers. They have a thing called longbow radar, and they are able to identify hundreds of targets inside of a second, and there's a computer program that sends firing instructions to Hellfire missiles that are carried on all of these Apaches. And unless there's an interruption by the pilots, the computer will fire those missiles at those targets as defined by the radar system.
Jim Dwyer, how long are troops expecting, or commanding officers there expecting it might take them to get from the Kuwaiti border to those outskirts of Baghdad where the Iraqi armor awaits?
Nobody knows that yet. I think it has to do with how much resistance they meet along the way, how much fight the regular Iraqi army puts up. And the expectation is that they're not going to put up very much fight at all. There's a lot of discussion about that already, that there's arrangements being made with commanders and so forth. I don't know how much of that is true. I mean, it would be complicated, very complicated, for them to do that in a day or, you know, maybe 2 days because of the fueling issues and the distances that are involved. It's a much, much bigger battlefield than in Desert Storm 1991.
So they will depend on troops on the ground racing forward with fuel, fuel lines, trucks full of fuel, all that material.
Correct, yes. There's a whole series of ways they're going to relay the fuel forward. Some of it will be done by air, and some of it will be done by ground convoy. I think the helicopters will outstrip the logistical support. That's the complicating issue.
Jim Dwyer, how would you assess the mood and morale there? What are soldiers talking about on what's approaching the eve of battle?
This is not a pleasant life here in the desert. You live in tents. You have no running water. They want to go home. And the way for them to go home is for this situation to be resolved. So there are some of them who are very keen for a fight. Some of them, if they were told that Saddam had surrendered or gone into exile in some way, would be delighted. All of them, though, are eager for this to be over with as soon as possible. And if it means going to battle, then they're ready to go into battle. I think that some of the ones who have been around longer, you have to realize the United States Army has been in, and the United States military has had over the last decade just a series of continuous situations where they've been deployed and in conflicts. And some people are a little battle-weary, but there's a lot of people who are trained quite well at this point.
And, Jim, when they go north, will you go with them?
I'm planning to, yeah.
By air or on the ground?
I think I'll probably go by air.
Jim Dwyer, we hope to talk to you again when you're in Iraq, I guess. And in the meantime, keep your head down, good luck, be safe, and thank you for speaking with us.
Okay, take care. Thank you. Bye now.
Jim Dwyer is a correspondent with the New York Times, embedded with the 101st Airborne Division. He spoke with me earlier from Camp New Jersey in northern Kuwait. Tony Blair has been a rock of support for the Bush administration's hard-line push against Saddam, but he's a rock in a very hard place. Blair's on the outs with France and Germany. Three of his own cabinet members have resigned in protest over his Iraq policies. His people have taken to the streets in large and bitter protest. In today's House of Commons debate, Blair said more is at stake than disarming Saddam. The fundamental framework of international relations, said the British Prime Minister, is being redrawn. Tony Blair has sacrificed for war, but he is an oddly multilateralist partner to the great unilateralist George Bush. Same war, different dreams, he might say, if candor would allow. Tonight, we're going to be listening in on Tony Blair and the fiery parliamentary debate today, listening to the different heartbeat of America's closest ally. Does Tony Blair make a better case for war than George W. Bush? Does he make a different case? Is Tony Blair George Bush's lapdog or his transatlantic conscience? And on the eve of war, is this the kind of debate you wish you had heard this week in Congress? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now from London is writer and analyst Anthony Dworkin. In a provocative piece in Sunday's Boston Globe entitled The Blair War Project, he said the British Prime Minister is on a mission and it's not George Bush's. Good evening and welcome, Anthony Dworkin.
Good evening. Hi. It's a pleasure to be on the show.
It's wonderful to have you, and thanks for staying up this hour to be with us. Really good of you. With me in the studio tonight is Pippa Norris, lecturer in comparative politics at Harvard's Kennedy School of Government. She is author of some 20 books on politics and public opinion, including Britain Votes 2001. Good evening, and welcome, Pippa Norris.
Pleasure to be here.
Very good to have you. And with us this hour from Hanover, New Hampshire, is On Point News analyst Jack Beattie, senior editor at The Atlantic Monthly. Hello, Jack.
Hello, Tom, and hello to our guests.
So here we are. Just right off the top, Anthony Dworkin, the votes in Parliament today. Is this a triumph for Tony Blair? Is it Tony Blair squeaking out a victory? What do the numbers tell us? What did the day tell us?
Well, in a way, it kind of testifies to the extraordinary position that Blair finds himself in, that this vote is being presented here as a relief for the government. And the relief for the government is that only 139 of its own members of parliament voted against it in the crucial amendment. Mm. Now, that's more Labour MPs than have ever voted against a Labour government, as far as can be established in parliamentary history. And yet, because the fears were that it could be greater, because we've had this building momentum of revolt and discontent and bitterness within the Labour Party that runs very deep, you know, they're relieved that it wasn't worse than that. And so, you know, I think Blair feels that he now has as good a wind as he could get to go into this war. And he knows that the party is very divided. He knows that he's going to have a lot to prove afterwards. But, you know, it could have been worse for him today.
Could have been worse. We're going to take a good, deep listen to Tony Blair's remarks and some of the debate in the British Parliament today. Let's start right off with his opening remarks to the House of Commons, laying out the importance of today's vote. Tony Blair.
The Prime Minister.
Deputy Speaker, I beg to move the motion standing on the order paper in my name and those of my right honourable friends. At the outset, I say it is right that this House debate this issue and pass judgment. That is the democracy that is our right, but that others struggle for in vain. And again, I say I do not disrespect the views of those in opposition to mine. This is a tough choice indeed, but it is also a stark one. To stand British troops down now and turn back, or to hold firm to the course that we have set, and I believe passionately we must hold firm to that course. The question most often posed is not why does it matter, but why does it matter so much? Here we are, the government with its most serious test, its majority at risk, the first cabinet resignation over an issue of policy, the main parties internally divided, people who agree on everything else. Ah, yes, of course, the Liberal Democrats. Unified as ever in opportunism and error. And the country and the Parliament reflect each other. A debate that, as time has gone on, has become less bitter but no less grave. So why does it matter so much? Because, Mr. Speaker, the outcome of this issue will now determine more than the fate of the Iraqi regime, more than the future of the Iraqi people, for so long brutalized by Saddam, important though those issues are. It will determine the way Britain and the world confront the central security threat of the 21st century, the development of the United Nations, the relationship between Europe and the United States, the relations within the European Union, and the way that the United States engages with the rest of the world. So it could hardly be more important. It will determine the pattern of international politics for the next generation.
Tony Blair, in opening remarks before the British Parliament, the House of Commons today, Pippa Norris here in the studio. Very different tone here, a kind of back and forth we don't get in presidential speeches to Congress. But Tony Blair had a lot on the line today. Was there any doubt that he would ultimately come out with a supportive vote for this war?
Well, they framed it that it could be worse. And the spin doctors in particular said it could be 150, it could be 160 backbench rebellion. And in the end, it was still very, very bad. It was deeply damaging. It's been the worst revolt against the government in this century. And so in that sense, even though we can say it's not as bad as some people expected, it's deeply damaging for the government and for Tony Blair.
We are looking tonight, and we're going to hear a lot more from that parliamentary speeches and debate. We're looking at Tony Blair's last stand for war. He won it. We'll look at what Great Britain gains and loses in the battle, and Tony Blair's vision for the world post-Saddam, how it's like and unlike George Bush's. You can join the conversation. Who makes the more persuasive case for war, Tony Blair or George Bush or neither? Are you with the unilateralist warrior or the multilateralist warrior or neither? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back.
From Boston University.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about Tony Blair's last stand for war and what Great Britain gains and loses in the battle. My guests tonight are Anthony Dworkin, joining us from London tonight. He's a London-based writer and analyst, author of the article in last Sunday's Boston Globe entitled The Blair War Project. And here in the studio, Pippa Norris, lecturer in comparative politics at Harvard's Kennedy School of Government, and of course our own Jack Beattie as well. Anthony Dworkin, we hear right there at the top Tony Blair saying to the British Parliament that this is not just about war, it's about the future of international relations. Now, this is not exactly the way or a top-level message that we hear George Bush conveying. You've written about the gap between Bush and Blair, even as they are allies. Describe that gap to us.
Well, first of all, to start with a point that they have in common, they both speak in very sweeping, very idealistic terms. But what Blair has, which I think George Bush doesn't have, is he has a real vision of a kind of expansive vision of world order. And he has his doctrine, which he calls the doctrine of the international community. And this is something that he first developed during the Kosovo War a few years ago. And it's been absolutely at the forefront of the way he's approached the Iraq crisis. And you can sum up this doctrine, you know, it has a grand name, but basically what it boils down to is the idea that we're all in this together. He thinks that all the most important issues confronting the world today are issues of interdependence, things which may take place within one country but affect other countries. And so what he really has is a kind of unified picture of how the world works and how things in one part of the world affect things in the other part of the world.
Does he see himself then
from issues of poverty, issues of injustice, to issues of weapons of mass destruction and terrorism? It's all a cohesive and very multilateral and cooperative thing.
But does he see himself then fighting the same war as George Bush? Because international community is maybe one of the last phrases that we associate with George Bush's embrace of this war and America's role in this century's world.
Well, this is the great irony of Tony Blair's position, is on this one point, how to deal with Saddam Hussein and his weapons of mass destruction, their agendas do overlap. But it's been very striking that all the way through, Blair has spoken very much of enforcing the will of the United Nations and making sure that Saddam Hussein disarms. There's been no talk from the British government of regime change. So, you know, even though they have a similar ideal of confronting Saddam Hussein and preventing him, as they would say, flouting the will of the international community. Mm. Even so, there's still some differences there, which, you know, which boil down to, was this war designed from the beginning to get rid of Saddam Hussein, or was it just an attempt to enforce disarmament on him?
And that came up today. Jack Beattie, here we are, solid allies and at the same time, odd bedfellows.
Odd bedfellows and solid allies indeed. And yet, for students of history, the parallel is so resonant between Winston Churchill and Franklin Roosevelt in 1940-41, with France conquered, with the Luftwaffe in the air. Mr. Churchill reached across the Atlantic to Franklin Roosevelt. As he said later, "I reached for your hand and you took it." And he did indeed take it. He wrote to him even as France was falling, "As you are no doubt aware, the scene has darkened swiftly. The enemy has a marked preponderance in the air. The small countries are smashed up like matchwood. And, Mr. President, I need this, and I need that, and I need the other." And Franklin Roosevelt, like Tony Blair, had a public opinion that was, if anything, even stronger against war, the intervention in the war, than Mr. Blair's. And yet Franklin Roosevelt, with principle and with stealth, over the next year and a half, sent destroyers to Britain, gave credits to Britain, had to face down his own armed services, who said, "Wait a minute, you can't send that plane to Britain. We need it." He said, "It's going to Britain." He had to face down ethnic groups in the United States, Irish Americans, Catholic Americans. He had to face down isolationist and young intellectuals. And he did it and showed a magnificent profile in courage in saving Britain in its hour of need when it was alone in the world. And now Tony Blair has returned that favor to George Bush. He's reached across the Atlantic and held Bush's hand. Bush doesn't need him to militarily, but he absolutely has to have him to show that this just isn't some cowboy venture, that some sane person in the world, Tony Blair and the British people, are with us.
Pippa Norris, is that what this is about? Is this Tony Blair saving America in its hour of need?
I think that that there are two different arguments going on. And when you heard President Bush and you heard Prime Minister Blair, you saw two different things. For Blair, his audience is the Labour Party. For the Labour Party, he focused on human rights, in other words, the problems that the Kurds and other groups have had under the regime. Mm-hmm. And he's also focused on issues of the authority of the United Nations. Mm-hmm. If you pass Resolution 1441 and you don't go ahead, you weaken the UN. President Bush, everything was framed in terms of 9/11, the threat to American security through Al-Qaeda. And that's the argument which resonates with the American public, but really doesn't hold the same degree of importance or salience for the British public.
Are you suggesting with that they're both driving toward exactly the same goal? They just had different political tacks in getting to war with Iraq? I'm hearing something different from Anthony Dworkin. Are you not buying that there are different agendas working here?
I think there are genuinely different agendas, different visions of the world, if you like. But they also come very much from the position of the two countries and the two leaders. In terms of British interests, for example, a small power in Europe, multilateralism, international links, the United Nations, the Security Council, the European Union is critical to their power. For George Bush, these are restraints on the only superpower. So they're articulating a different vision which comes from their own position in the world.
Is Tony Blair trying to switch horses here, Anthony Dworkin? Is he still devoted to multilateralism, or is he hitching his sidecar to the big hyperpower motorcycle here?
Well, the problem for Tony Blair is that Britain is, as Pippa Norris was saying, Britain is not a big, powerful country. And so he has this vision of world order, which is, it's an internationalist vision, but it's also a tough internationalist vision. He thinks it's very important that in the end you have to have the threat of force to back these things up. Britain can't do that. America can. So he knows that he has to go along with America, working to kind of smooth its rough edges a bit if there is going to be a credible threat of force at the end of it.
But does he think he can ultimately pull the United States back into a multilateralist regime that is not the current dream we hear coming out of Washington?
No, and I think Tony Blair hoped he could do it, and he's ended up in the position he didn't want to be in. You know, Tony Blair is a liberal internationalist. He believes in global order backed by force, but with a kind of consensual multilateral framework. And if you like, what's happened is he's had to give up on one of the two pillars of his liberal internationalism. He's been able to go with this idea of confronting Saddam Hussein, enforcing the UN resolutions, and stopping what he sees as a real threat to global order. But in doing that, he's had to give up on the idea of doing it through the sort of institutions that give procedural legitimacy in international affairs, the Security Council and so on. So he's ended up in a much more unilateral position.
It's a big piece to give up. Let's listen to a bit more from the House of Commons debate today. Here is Scottish National Party MP Alex Salmond asking Blair why he changed his position regarding UN involvement.
But would my right honourable friend not agree there's a criticism to be made of all the member countries that make up the Security Council of the United Nations, namely that it has taken 12 years to reach this point? Why wasn't action taken earlier? And in fact, the delay and the frustration and the rest of it has surely only encouraged the Iraqi dictator to act as he has done. Surely the time has reached the position now when there would be no justification for further delay.
Mr. Speaker, I truly believe that our fault has not been impatience. The truth is that our patience should have been exhausted weeks and months and even years ago.
The Prime Minister says that the French have changed their position. But surely the French, the Russians and the Chinese always made it clear that they would oppose a second resolution which gave automatic war. Well, they published at a time of 1441. Isn't it the Prime Minister that changed his position? Because a month ago he said the only circumstances he would go to war without a second resolution were if the inspectors concluded there was no more progress, which they haven't, if there was a majority in the Security Council, which there's not, and there was an unreasonable veto from one country. There are three countries of permanent members opposed to the Prime Minister's policy. When did he change his position and why?
First of all, he is absolutely wrong on what he says about the position in relation to 1441. It is correct that 1441 did not itself say that there would be a resolution authorizing force, but the implication of 1441 and what it stated in terms in the resolution was that if they continued to be a material breach, defined as not cooperating fully, immediately and unconditionally, serious consequences should follow. And all we are asking for in this second resolution is the clear ultimatum that if Saddam carries on not cooperating, then force should be used. And the French position is, I'm afraid, France will vote no, whatever the circumstances. Not my words, those of the French president. And I find it sad that at this point in time, he cannot support us in the position we have set out, which is the only sure way to disarm Saddam.
Wrong again.
And what indeed, Mr. Speaker, would any tyrannical regime possessing weapons of mass destruction, viewing the history of the world's diplomatic dance with Saddam over these 12 years, that our capacity, I'm afraid, to pass firm resolutions has only been matched by our feebleness in implementing them. And that is why this indulgence has to stop, because it is dangerous. It is dangerous if such regimes disbelieve us. Dangerous if they think they can use our weakness, our hesitation, even the natural urges of our democracy towards peace against us.
Tony Blair, in the House of Commons today, you hear the debate, the back and forth, the criticism of the UK for not sticking with its drive for a second UN resolution. A familiar rhetoric there to American ears and yet a different tone. You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. David's calling from Brookline, Massachusetts. Hi, David. You're on the air.
Hello there. I'm enjoying the program. Very interesting topic, and I'd like to hear the guests are saying. I think some of my question was already answered. My point I was going to make was the way that you're using the term unilateralist to describe President Bush and multilateralist to describe Tony Blair is a little unfair, I think.
How so, David?
I believe that Tony Blair is a much more eloquent speaker, and he makes a more poignant argument that resonates better. And President Bush is a little bit ill-equipped in this way to elucidate his point, but I think that it takes a President Bush to allow Blair to be that. In other words, someone's going to have to step up and be the point of the spear, or someone's going to have to take charge and sort of push the issue forward, and everyone else can sort of then come aboard. But if the United States, in this case, theoretically didn't exist, would Tony Blair be standing up for the same principles as sternly? And so, I'll take the answer off the air.
Great, David. You see a kind of good cop, bad cop routine here. We're going to get our guests' response to that, but let's hear from Tony Blair on that very subject first. He spoke today to the MP's fear of U.S. unilateralism. Let's hear that.
The paralysis of the UN has been born out of the division there is. And I want to deal with that in just this way. At the heart of that division is the concept of a world in which there are rival poles of power. The US and its allies in one corner, France, Germany, Russia, and its allies in the other. I do not believe that all of these nations intend such an outcome, but that is what now faces us. I believe such a vision to be misguided and profoundly dangerous for our world. I know why it arises. There is resentment of US predominance. There is fear of US unilateralism. People ask, do the US listen to us and our preoccupations? And there is perhaps a lack of full understanding of US preoccupations after the 11th of September. I know all of this, but the way to deal with it is not rivalry, but partnership. Partners are not servants, but neither are they rivals. And I say this, Mr. Speaker, what Europe should have said last September to the United States is this. With one voice, it should have said, we understand your strategic anxiety over terrorism and weapons of mass destruction, and we will help you meet it. We will mean what we say in any UN resolution we pass, and we will back it with action if Saddam fails to disarm voluntarily. But in return, Europe should have said, we ask two things of you. That the US should indeed choose the UN path, and that it should recognize the fundamental overriding importance of restarting the Middle East peace process, which we hold you to. That would have been the right and responsible way for Europe and America to treat each other as partners. And it is a tragedy that it has not happened. I do not believe there is any other issue with the same power to reunite the world community than progress on the issues of Israel and Palestine. Of course, there is cynicism about recent announcements, but the United States is now committed, and I believe genuinely, to the roadmap for peace designed in consultation with the UN. It will now be presented to the parties as Abu Mazen is confirmed in office, hopefully today as Palestinian Prime Minister. And all of us are now signed up to this vision, a state of Israel recognized and accepted by all the world, and a viable Palestinian state. That is what this country should strive for, and we will. And that should be part of a larger global agenda on poverty and sustainable development, on democracy and human rights, on the good governance of nations. That is why what happens after any conflict in Iraq is of such critical significance.
Tony Blair in the House of Commons today in London. Jack Beattie, he puts his finger here on what he sees as the place where the dialogue broke down between the U.S. and Europe. He says that Europe should have asked a price of the United States for its full support in this war in Iraq. A, that the U.S. go entirely through the U.N., and B, that it push for a settlement between Israel and the Palestinians. He says it's a tragedy that that did not happen.
Yes, a kind of grand bargain. He was pleading with Bush even before the Israeli election to publish this roadmap, and the Bush administration, partly at the persuasion of Elliot Abrams, who now handles these things in the National Security Council, basically sort of intervened in the Israeli election by not publishing it as a favor to Mr. Sharon, because if they had published it, Mr. Sharon would have had to commit himself on the questions of the settlements. So that was a kind of he defied the other Bush did, the other members of the quartet, and then Blair had been pleading with him to publish it now in the lead up to the war. And apparently his plea got at least as far as Mr. Bush saying, I will publish it once the Palestinians reform. So I think that this vision that Mr. Blair says the United States didn't understand then, Blair is sort of, I think, making it his quid pro quo. Mr. Bush, this is what you owe me. And it is, and the only reason I think Mr. Bush gave that speech was for Mr. Blair, not just to help him politically, but because this is the Blair vision of peace. The Bush vision of peace and democracy in the Middle East seems to be, you know, you knock over Iraq and then democracy will spread. The Blair vision is we have to deal with the central issue of Israel-Palestine first and simultaneously in order to be credible in that part of the world.
We are talking tonight about Tony Blair's last stand for war in the British Parliament today, and what Great Britain gains and loses in the battle. Maybe different points of view on the world from Tony Blair and George W. Bush. You can join the conversation. Does Blair offer a more generous vision of Western power projection? And after the bombs fall, can the Bush-Blair marriage last? Does Washington have the patience for Blair's high-minded ideals for a more just world order? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about Tony Blair's last stand for war in the British Parliament today and what Great Britain gains and loses in the battle in Iraq, where the marriage of convenience, perhaps, maybe something more, with the United States goes once the battle with Iraq is over. You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. My guests tonight from London, England, Anthony Dworkin, editor of the Crimes of War Project, London-based writer and analyst. Here in the studio, Pippa Norris, lecturer in comparative politics at Harvard's Kennedy School of Government. Anthony Dworkin, what about these two points that Tony Blair raises so high? He says Europe made a tragic mistake in not insisting that the United States stay within the UN context, A, and that B, that there be material progress, a real push, maybe even real pressure and more for Middle East peace, pressure on Israelis and Palestinians. Now that the U.S. is out of the U.N., and George Bush has spoken to the roadmap, but in a very vague way, does Tony Blair still have leverage with George Bush on these fronts? Can he still demand U.S. action somehow, or is he now just going to be riding along on the wild horse of American power?
Well, that's the fear here. That's the fear among the Labour Party, is that Blair has sold his soul to the Americans who don't share his values, and he doesn't have enough leverage. But my sense is, in the last few days, Blair feels that he's got two crucial things out of the Americans, one of which is, as we've talked about, this commitment to publish the roadmap and push forward with the Middle East peace process.
Though George Bush, when he spoke to that, delivered that message in a way that made the roadmap quite a malleable document, which was, I think, at odds with what the intent that the quartet, Tony Blair included, had.
Yes, I would agree. I mean, to me, that was the absolute minimum.
So it could be form without substance there.
It could. I mean, there was nothing definite there. It was a kind of gesture. It was really a gesture, and that was all. Maybe it'll come to something, maybe it won't. Mm-hmm. There's not much there to count on. The second point is what's going to happen in Iraq after the war. And that is a point that is of crucial significance in Britain, because a lot of the suspicion about the Bush administration's project for the world is that it's basically a kind of American military imperialism. And if Iraq, after the war, is going to look like an American military zone of occupation, that is going to cause enormous difficulties for Tony Blair. What Blair wants is something that's going to be much more compatible with his picture of a just, rule-governed world. He wants something where the UN is very involved. Maybe you had to go around the UN to get into the war, but for Blair, it is essential that the UN should be there helping pick up the pieces afterwards.
And does he really have a commitment to that, Anthony Dworkin? We're reading in the U.S. newspapers every day about plans for huge private American corporations to take the lead in the reconstruction of Iraq. What does Tony Blair think he's got in terms of a commitment from George Bush on that?
I can't say what he's got in terms of commitment. I think what he feels he's got is something, some kind of indication that his concerns will be listened to. In the end, how enforceable is it? I don't know. You know, clearly, I think the impression that you get here is that the American administration has some sense that Blair's support is a kind of moral imprimatur, which is worth something to them. But, you know, as Donald Rumsfeld rather brutally said the other day, you know, if we need to, we can do this without the Brits. And no one can tell whether that mysterious comment that he made was meant as a favor or as a veiled threat to Britain, but it cuts both ways.
It must hurt in London. Let's get one more chunk of Tony Blair today before the British Parliament.
For those of us who support the course I'm advocating, that means all the dangers of war. But for others opposed to this course, it means, let us be clear, that the Iraqi people, whose only true hope lies in the removal of Saddam, for them, the darkness will simply close back over. They will be left under his rule without any possibility of liberation. If this House now demands that at this moment, faced with this threat from this regime, that British troops are pulled back, that we turn away at the point of reckoning, and this is what it means, what then? What will Saddam feel, strengthened beyond measure? What will the other states who tyrannize their people, the terrorists who threaten our existence, what will they take from that? That the will confronting them is decaying and feeble. Who will celebrate and who will weep if we take our troops back from the Gulf now? And if our plea is for America to work with others, to be as good as well as powerful allies, if our plea is for America to work with others, to be good as well as powerful allies, will our retreat make them multilaterals? Or will it rather not be the biggest impulse to unilateralism that we could possibly imagine? And what of the United Nations then, and the future of Iraq, and the Middle East peace process, devoid of our influence, stripped of our insistence? The House wanted this discussion before conflict. It has it. And these are the choices. And in this dilemma, no choice is perfect. No choice is ideal. But on this decision hangs the fate of many things, of whether we summon the strength to recognize the global challenge of the 21st century and meet it, of the Iraqi people groaning under years of dictatorship, of our armed forces, brave men and women of whom we can feel proud, whose morale is high and whose purpose is clear, of the institutions and alliances that will shape our world for years to come. To retreat now, I believe, would put at hazard all that we hold dearest. Turn the United Nations back into a talking shop, stifle the first steps of progress in the Middle East, leave the Iraqi people to the mercy of events, tell our allies that at the very moment of action, at the very moment when they need our determination, that Britain faltered. I will not be party to such a course.
Yeah.
This is not the time to falter. This is the time for this House, not just this government or indeed this Prime Minister, but for this House to give a lead. To show that we will stand up for what we know to be right. To show that we will confront the tyrannies and dictatorships and terrorists who put our way of life at risk. To show at the moment of decision that we have the courage to do the right thing, I beg to move the motion.
Tony Blair today in the House of Commons, Pippin Norris. Here we are hearing the British Prime Minister in his summation, a summation that has as much to do with managing the U.S. superpower as with disarming Iraq, as I hear it. You're listening and watching this debate from the American side of the pond here. You hear him pleading, if we don't do this, we'll be devoid of influence with this great unilateral power. But in your assessment, is Tony Blair's broader agenda, that international community agenda, is it being respected or used by the Bush administration?
Well, I think that Bush needs Blair and Blair needs Bush. There's basically a marriage of convenience, as you said earlier, Tom, and they're an odd couple. But basically, when you think about the coalition which has come up, the coalition of the willing, it doesn't look that credible in many ways if Britain was not there. Bulgaria is not committing troops. Poland today said they're going to put in 200 troops. Australia is putting in 1,000, but these are token symbolic gestures.
So the US needs it, but is Tony Blair getting the short end of the stick for his broader agenda?
I think that so far, clearly, he's had to make lots of compromises. Particularly, he'd always been committed to the UN Security Council and getting that en pratique before any sort of motion, and that has had to go by the wayside, partly because of the French, partly because of the Germans, because of the ways that events came out of his control.
And Anthony Dworkin, if I may, we just have 20 seconds here, but Tony Blair's messianic idealism, is it getting short shrift from Washington? Is it getting shoved down his throat even as he joins Washington in war?
I would say he's getting the absolute minimum. He's not getting as much as he would like. He's not getting as much as people in Britain would like. And he's getting, I would say, the absolute minimum possible from Bush.
Anthony Dworkin, it's been great having you tonight. I want to thank you for joining us to listen to Tony Blair at this great hour in London. Thank you so much for being with us.
It's been a pleasure.
Anthony Dworkin is editor of the Crimes of War Project, and Pippin Norris here in the studio. Just tremendous having you. Thank you so much for coming in.
Thank you.
Pippin Norris is lecturer in comparative politics at Harvard's Kennedy School of Government, editor and author of some 20 books, including most recently Britain Votes 2001. Jack Beattie, here's this eloquent voice, here's this ally, but singing a song a bit different from our own presidents.
Yes, and here we see a conviction politician, and how rare that is for those of us, especially who believe that democracy is not reducible to majoritarianism, to see a leader standing up on principle, taking an unpopular course, but confident or hopeful that the people will reward his courage, respect his honor, and perhaps even recognize that he was right.
And yet, still to be seen how his great ally across the Atlantic ultimately recognizes all that. Jack, thanks for being with us this hour.
Thank you.
Listeners, you can continue this conversation online. Go to onepointradio.org and click on forums. In a moment, a look from inside Kurdish-controlled northern Iraq. This is On Point. Over the next several weeks, we'll be bringing you radio diaries from reporters in and around Iraq who will share stories of how the looming war is affecting ordinary people in the region. Tonight, we hear from the Christian Science Monitor's Cameron Barr in Kurdish-controlled northern Iraq. The Kurds have high hopes for regime change in Iraq. Saddam has frequently targeted them, including in 1998 when the Iraqi dictator unleashed a brutal chemical attack. The ultimatum issued last night by President Bush was celebrated in the Kurdish-controlled areas of Iraq today. In this radio diary from northern Iraq, Cameron Barr says the message is finally getting through that war really is coming.
I was in a town called Cham Chamal today, which is a border town. Although border is not the right word. It's a town on the line that demarcates the end of Iraqi government control and the beginning of Kurdish control. And there I met a young family. The man said that he had spent early Tuesday morning, secretly tuning in to a U.S. government-funded radio station called Radio Sawa, listening to Arabic language reports about Bush's speech. And it was at that moment that he and his wife decided that war was upon them and that they should flee. And they took their three boys and got into a bus in Kirkuk and took the bus to Cham Chamal. And I met them. They were sitting in the dust by the side of the road, and the mother was suckling her one-year-old. And they were trying to sort themselves out and figure out to which relative they could go to try to sit out the war in an area that struck them as safer as than Kirkuk. And so there was a kind of dread on their part and a kind of sadness, especially from the mother, to have left her home. At the same time, there's a sense among the Kurds that the Americans are going to come through this time. And these people said, a lot of people coming off the bus from Kirkuk, as well as other Kurds in Cham Chamal, that they felt very happy listening to Bush, especially the ultimatum. One guy said that his only complaint about Bush's speech was that the 48-hour period was too long. He would have preferred 24 hours or as soon as possible for Saddam to leave. But even so, there is this, I suppose, celebration isn't too strong a word to describe what the Kurds feel as they see the Americans moving in. Kurds have a sort of finely tuned sense of what artillery distance means. So, you know, many people are just moving back from the front lines because they know that they won't be reachable by Iraqi artillery, and they're fairly confident that the Americans will deny what remains of the Iraqi Air Force any access to the skies. So people are simply coming back, they're moving to the village, and that's also the advice of the governments here, who have told people to get out of the cities and go to the village because, you know, the cities pose a much more tempting target for Saddam Hussein's forces. There's a lot of confidence that the Iraqis will be too busy dealing with the Americans to make any inroads into Iraqi Kurdistan, although people, as I said, do worry about shelling. You know, the city of Erbil, which is really the biggest city in northern Iraq, a million people probably, is emptying out, and that's because Erbil is in artillery range from the Iraqi line. You know, I've been here for 6 weeks, and, you know, even though it's been glaringly obvious to most observers that the Americans were determined to attack, the Kurds always struck me as very, very skeptical. In countless conversations, I would have people ask me, you know, do you really think it's going to happen? Do you really think? And I would say, well, you know, I think so. It seems to me that the White House is determined to proceed. But they never really believed it until the Bush speech. That struck Kurds as the real deal. You have the President of the United States saying 48 hours. And somehow that is more real to them than any amount of coverage of the military buildup, because they have seen that kind of force arrayed in the past, particularly in 1991, and it wasn't used to depose Saddam Hussein. But those stark statements from President Bush really sunk home, I think.
Cameron Barr is Middle East correspondent for the Christian Science Monitor. He shared his observations from Kurdish-controlled northern Iraq. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
This is WBUR. We're funded by you, our listeners, and by